Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, please sit back because you are now about to go behind the blue curtain.
What's going on, Ali? Ali, Ali in the house over there on the Facebook Live. The crew's lining up. We're about to get started.
Get it down.
In the house. If you guys get a chance, go over there to the Facebook Live. You get there on Stan Mason on Facebook. They host a whole new show over there. They have good discussions, good dialogue. We have a lot of different information over there. But then over here, we're going to keep it live. You guys can call in 646-416-4621. Weigh in. Give us your expertise. We'll get this show going. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Saturday. February 16th. Time to get it started. 3 more days to my big birthday in the house. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain, everybody. I'm your host, Stan Mason. Once again, like I said, every week, this is not my show. This is our show. This is a show where you get a chance to call in, and you're not limited to 30-second sound bites. You get to call in and weigh in on the conversation, the topic, say how you feel. Nobody's going to cut you off. This show is not geared towards the political status of anyone, Republican, Democrat. We don't care if you're rich, poor, black, white, Hispanic, straight, gay, Christian, Muslim. It doesn't matter here. Like I always say, you know, you can be a crack addict in a back alley with a bomber phone and a Wi-Fi connection, but if you get on here, you're in. Shout out to Woody Wood, big brother, DJ Woody Wood, all the way from New Jersey in the house. Appreciate you being here, brother. You know, what I want to do today is talk about a topic that kind of really kind of sums up my career here as I get down to the end of mine, and share the wealth. And what I look at is a lot of times we see cities that you may have a city that has gone through a lot of crime. For instance, my city here in Waco, when I started in the 90s, it was just inundated with crime. I mean, this was probably the worst place to live. You would not have wanted to live here. You probably couldn't give your house away. And we, like everyone, we struggled with the crack cocaine epidemic, and we had shootings and stabbings, and it was just commonplace. The citizens were at their wits' end. The police department, our manning was stretched, and we were, you know, just running call to call to call. And a lot of these calls were murders. There were stabbings and shootings and criminal mischiefs and burglaries. And so, you know, you went to work and just ran calls. And then a strange thing happened. My department got a grant and invested in community policing. Now, you guys want to know why does he harp so much on community policing? Well, when they went into the grant, they picked initially about 15 of us, and some were in a bike unit, and some of us went into neighborhoods, of which I went into work in the neighborhoods. And, you know, Manning Short, and, you know, they were going to try this experiment with community policing. So out of the what ended up being only 5 neighborhood officers, each one of us basically had almost a quarter of the city, which was a lot. And I happened to have what was District 1, which was the worst area. But, you know, I lived in that area, so I had that connection. When I went out, and it's really amazing, and I did the first set of meetings with people, I found out that what the police department thought were the problems in that neighborhood were not the immediate problems to the neighbors. For instance, where we may have thought murder was the big issue, to them it was loud music. I can't sleep. This music over here is too loud. So, you know, you meet with the neighbors and, you know, you get into your meetings and it's harsh. It gets ugly in there because you're dealing with a community that has not had real, honest, open dialogue with our police department. And our chief, that was 100% behind what we did, allowed us to be totally honest with the community. Now, it was successful because at the time our city manager here and our mayor were 100% behind our efforts, and officers were given a lot of latitude. And long story short, Waco, the citizens and the police department worked together. The police department didn't do it all by themselves, and the citizens didn't do it all by themselves. We pulled in a lot of city resources. And this city has gone from one of the worst places in America to live to probably one of the best places in America to live. And, you know, a lot of folks can't even afford to retire and stay here anymore and, you know, much less buy a house. I said, so, you know, that's the upside. of what community policing can do. Now, the danger that comes with it is when you have a city where you've come from the remnants, the ashes, and you rose like a phoenix. You came up out of all this crime and low property value and homelessness and unemployment and all these things you overcame, and you forget where you came from. You know, we get comfortable, and then a lot of the people who fought these wars in the 90s, a lot of them are no longer here. They've passed on or moved on, and so that's a lot of experience that you have that leaves the neighborhood. So then when you don't have that core to draw back on that experience, it's not documented, it's not written, no one archived it, you have a danger of sliding back into that crime-ridden society, and then you don't know how to get out again. And then sometimes we sit back and we look at our sister cities that are next to us struggling with the same things we struggled, and we say, oh, man, that's there. I'm glad I'm not there. Well, once upon a time, we were there. We were that place. And I just thought, you know, I wonder what would happen if a city that has come out of that type of environment ever said, you know, let's get a delegation. Let's take maybe two officers from the police department, maybe five citizens, maybe a couple of business people, somebody from city politics, excuse me, and put a delegation together, and let's go meet with a delegation from that sister city next to us that's going through what we went through. And then we sit down and we listen to them. We don't go in and say, hey, we got it together, look at us. We go in and we listen to them. And then we say, okay, these are some things that we did that worked for us. And you let that officer work with some of the officers who were in the targeted zone at that city. Some of the citizens work with the citizens in that targeted zone to teach them how to work with the police, what we expect, things we can do, things we can't do. We can explain it, but it's better coming from a citizen. Get some of their city management to look at what our city management is doing and maybe emulate some of the things or adjust some of the things we've done to be successful and implement them there. Now, all of a sudden, you've got one city helping another city, which builds trust and friendship. And as long as you can get the roaches in the dining room, they won't get to the kitchen, you know, so to speak. And I think we just need to have that kind of involvement. If you really think about it, the beginning steps of getting your city safe, it starts in your house. You've got to have a different attitude, a proactive attitude. Yes, you can be frustrated, but at the end of the day, we can do all the complaining and finger-pointing. But at what point do you come out of the house and get to the front porch? Once you get out there, you affect your street. Once you affect your street, it impacts your neighborhood. Once your neighborhood is right, it's going to impact your city. Once your city's right, it'll impact your county. Once you get your counties on board, it impacts your state. And people say, I don't know if that can happen. It absolutely can happen. I've seen it happen. And you say, I can't change the world. I can't change it. You can make a difference. I mean, let's think about it. Drug dealers in Texas, they network with drug dealers in Chicago, who network with drug dealers in Los Angeles, who network within the city. The guys on the east side of town talk to the guys on the west side of town. The guys on 123 Rose Street speak to the guys on 976 Palm Street. See, criminals network. Why don't we? If they're doing something that's working for their benefit in one area, they'll get a hold of the people in the next area and say, hey, start doing this. And then we say, well, how did the criminals take over? They took over because they communicate and they network. If the good people would learn to communicate and network, and I know businesses compete against each other, but what good is competition when you have nothing to compete with? Let me drop up to the 804, Big Gus in the house. What's going on, Gus?
Hey, how you doing, my brother? All is good and well. Hey, look, the only issue I see with that is, you know, certain neighborhoods, i.e., you know, black, Hispanic, might look at the police as an occupying force, even though they're there to do community policing. I think that might be a problem in certain areas. I know they kind of look at that like here in the south side of Richmond, because they do. They have a heavy police presence here, but, you know, some of the residents think that it's, they're here, you know, they're harassing us and they're doing that. But, no, they're actually knocking on doors and trying to communicate with the, you know, with the police, because that's what Chief Durham was doing when he was here. He was always out in the neighborhood. He was always out in the neighborhood knocking on doors and asking people, getting the feel of what's going on. I think if we do that, we shouldn't have a big of a problem. But, you know, and it also deals with different, you know, localities, like their tax structure is set up differently. So just because the cities are sister cities, you know, their pay structure is different. Like, for instance, here in the city, I live in the city of Richmond. The neighboring counties, Chesterfield, Henrico County, pay at least $9,000 to $10,000 more a year for police officers. And then Richmond wonder why they can't keep good officers here. And they're always trying to, you know, transfer out. So I think that all has a lot to do with it.
You know what, Gus? You're right. But I think how you overcome some of that is this is the thing that policing has a hard time understanding, and the community does too. It's not how many officers you send to something. It's who you send to that problem. You know, there are some officers you can send to a riot and they can turn it into a prayer meeting. There are other officers that you can send to a prayer meeting and you're going to have a riot. So when you talk about implementing community policing or this type of sister city adoption program I'm talking about, you sit down, the community is involved from the beginning. You don't develop the plan as the city and then drop it on them. They're not going to trust that. And quite frankly, if I was the neighborhood officer in it, I wouldn't trust it either. Because when you implement community policing, the officers that are on the ground, you know, you'll have people that sit in different positions that say, oh, we're behind you, we applaud you. But you got to understand now, some people are applauding you for their political position. Some people are applauding you because it's going to make their section or their part of the city a little easier. But those citizens don't have anything to bargain with. So when they applaud you, it's going to be 100. Let the citizens say, okay, we're going to send 5 officers into your neighborhood for the next year to focus on nothing but community policing and problem solving. Which 5 do you all want? Let the citizens pick who they want in their neighborhood. It might surprise a lot of police departments because if you're talking about a black neighborhood, everybody they pick may not be black. Because
right.
There are a lot of stereotypes that are out there that aren't true. But nobody bothers asking the citizens. So if you let the citizens pick the officers, doesn't matter whether the chief likes them or whatever the case may be, you're going to have a big hurdle right there you got to be over. And the community will feel a lot more comfortable with those officers moving around in it than it would, say, having officers they don't know. And, yes, it is very expensive. But so are these lawsuits are very expensive. You know, the crime is very expensive. The low-tax neighborhoods or no-tax-revenue neighborhoods are very expensive. You know, the investigating cases is expensive. Presenting cases in the district attorney's office, you know, taxes, it's very expensive. So at some point, you got to get to where you say, okay, the rubber meets the road right here. Either you want to save your city or you don't. And that's officers and citizens. Now, not every officer you have in a department is cut out for community policing. It's just not. Some of them will tell you, "I don't need to do that. That's howdy-doody friendly policing. I don't need to do that." And that's their mentality, and that's fine. But those people, as a department, you need to identify who they are. Not to say that you target them or fire them, but if they don't want to communicate and interact with the community, that's someone that's going to be detrimental to your department down the line. And you're going to be on one of these Facebook or YouTube videos and sitting in some courtroom somewhere. If that makes any sense to you.
And that makes plenty of sense. I'm just, you know, part of that is I'm worried about to happen here. You know, the feelings, and, you know, it sounds kind of funny, but the feelings of a certain city, if another city tried to tell them that their department is doing something wrong, or should they just come up with the idea themselves, or, you know, some people get an ass on their back, excuse me for better words, if another department tries to tell them what they're doing.
Right. But the thing is, it's not like, for instance, it wouldn't be the city coming in saying this is, or the delegation, this is what you are doing wrong. See, it's how you present something. When you can come to me and you can say, you know, Stan, I've been where you're at. I see what you're going through. I've been through it, man. And I know it's not easy getting out. I got some things I know that may help you. as opposed to you coming in telling me what I need to do to get out of the problem that I'm in. And for a lot of these cities, if you're too proud to accept help when you know you need it, then, you know, you're contributing to the current situation that you're in. And there comes a time where you're going to need help, but cities have to stop investing countless dollars on grants thinking they can buy their way out of crime-ridden neighborhoods, that you can elect your way out of crime-ridden neighborhoods until people roll up their sleeves and decide that they're going to get in the trenches and do some work and stop bickering over who's black and who's white and who's straight and who's gay and who's Christian and who's not and who gets to be in charge. You know what? When you get there, just let God be in charge, because Lord knows the reason why you have these crime conditions is because people in charge have sat back and watched it happen, regardless of who they are. If we're voting the same people to constantly be in charge of leading us out of the problem, who are sitting there governing or counseling us through the problem that they perpetuate through never being at the problem, it's never going to get better. Oh, yeah, it's got to get ugly for a minute. You know, you can't eat the omelet without breaking some eggs. And sometimes you got to beat them to get it right. You know, and that's just the hard truth of it. This is not a pretty thing to go through, but going through it together is really good. And then growing and looking at the results of coming through, having gone through, taking your neighborhood back, and then moving and helping another city. I'm going to drop to the 414 area code real quick, Gus. We got another caller in, last 40432. Good morning.
Good morning, Stan. Delani, Gus.
How are you?
Packing, but I had to call in today.
Okay.
I agree with both of you guys, and I do believe that the city, the police chief, everybody should work with the communities that they're policing in. I mean, we all got our issues with each other, but we have to start somewhere. So they need to hold a community meeting, and they need to talk to each other and try to work out the kinks, not trying to put each other down or place the blame where it probably don't even belong. Work together. How hard is it to develop a plan and slowly start implementing that plan? Especially, like, let's say with the rookies or people coming into the community, before they actually get placed in the district, why can't they go out there in case the district and get to know the people?
There you go. You know, that you're right, because so many people come into this job, and this is something that we're going to have to go to the elephant in the room for a minute. This is one of the things that aggravates some people from a community standpoint, and I think a lot of times officers view the show or listen to the show, and they'll say, well, you know, you don't know how the community feels. Well, the last time I checked, I was part of the community. At least I am, because I haven't moved out of my city. I still police in the city that I work in. And, you know, sometimes we have a segment of or a group of people who believe that a particular condition does not exist because they have never experienced it. We have to learn to understand when a person complains about a particular entity, give that some validity, not to point fingers, but to work through it. We've got to get through the things that stop us from communicating in order to communicate. And folks' feelings can't get hurt in that conversation. And it doesn't always have to be the preacher that's in charge. That's another thing that this is my opinion. You know, I'm not talking about every preacher that historically in some neighborhoods you'll see, well, Reverend so-and-so is going to represent our neighborhood. And, you know, you let them pick who they want. And that's fine and good. But then if that church is sitting there not actively being that pillar in the community anyway, and you dump all of this social experiment on them, it's going to quickly fizzle out. You got single mothers in some of these neighborhoods that would love to do something like this because it gives them a getaway. You know, you've got a lot of people that are retired that would love to get their hands into something like this because it gives them that getaway. You get to see the results. When you don't hear gunshots anymore in your neighborhood and you find out that there are actually these things with feathers that sit in trees, they call them birds, but they make noise in the morning. See, when the gunfire leaves, they come. When you see kids can go to school and not have to worry about stepping over drug-addicted people or dead bodies or running from gang members. See, the police can't fix that problem. We like to let you all think we can. We can't fix that problem because when we show up, the gang members leave. It's like the exterminator. He can come spray your house for roaches, but ultimately you got to change the way you live for the roaches to go away. Now the exterminator gets the credit, but it's you changing your lifestyles that made a difference in your house. You know, it's not an easy process. You're absolutely right. And it is, you got to overcome a lot of trust issues. And, you know, deal with the police officers one-on-one. I don't like every police officer, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you I do, and not all of them like me. And that's fine. That's their thing. But I deal with officers individually, no matter what department, no matter where they work, what shift they work. There are some that I like, and there are some that I don't. And there's some of them I'm never going to like them. I can work with them, you know, to get through whatever we have to get through, but they're not coming to my house, and I'm not going to theirs. That's the hard truth of it. Everybody who does this job doesn't. We're not one big blue family where everybody gets along. They're not going to tell you that. They'll get mad that I said it, but it's the truth. We're no different than your job. See, a conversation like this is the first step. Once you find out that what is real in policing, we're people. We eat, we have bills, we have problems. We're wrong sometimes, we're right sometimes. We get angry, we get frustrated. We get tired, we work long hours like everybody. We're no better than anybody else. And once you have that conversation, it makes people go, man, that guy's real. Come out and represent you. And then people can learn about the department through you. But if you come out always upholding the department and upholding the city, at what point are you upholding you? And you know as well as I do in the hood, people want to build a relationship and trust with you. You know, the city and the department can come second. If that makes any sense.
Oh, I agree with you. And like you said, we do need to start in the home, in the neighborhood. And I think we should depend on the people who have been in the neighborhood long periods of time, because they are the ones who probably know the whole neighborhood, probably talk to each one of these kids and the officers. I believe we do need a foundation like that.
We do, you know, many of us just start with learning the history of your street. What was that burned out building that everybody walked by? What did it used to be? What used to be there? You know, then you start taking some pride. When I grew up, you know, up there in Harrisburg, I mean, with every street you went to, everybody had this tremendous pride of their street. And it wasn't a gang mentality, but everybody on that street was one family. Literally, and there's some of these people on my Facebook now from up here, they'll tell you, you could walk in anybody's house at dinner time and sit down at the table, you didn't get treated any different, and whether you lived there or whether you didn't. And we had virtually no crime in our neighborhood because you knew all the criminals. You watched them grow up. But that concept has gone away. You know, some neighbors surrendered that to the police like they're babysitters. Now the police will take care of it. It's not my responsibility. Well, now people want to blame the police for the hell that they got in their neighborhoods, when the fact of the matter is they know every single person raised in hell in the neighborhood because they knew them when they were babies. But instead of encouraging,
I have one more question.
Lifting each other up. Huh?
I have one more question. I don't know if they should do this or not, or they don't want to. But you know how they have innocent lives are taken by the police. So why can't the police officer come out and support that community? And, you know, we understand you going through this, but give us time to work out the situation and grieve with the community. Just like when a police officer is slain, the whole community grieves. So why can't they do the same? Or is that even possible?
Now let me ask you this. Do you want a politically correct answer from me, or do you want my personal opinion? Wait
a minute. Not when it first happened. Maybe a couple of days later.
No,
go ahead and give me your answer.
I'm going to give you my personal experience. Because when you say how you feel about a situation, and when you speak up about a situation, folks' feelings get hurt. See, policing has people's feelings get hurt when you speak on something that the profession thinks I don't agree with. I will tell you personally, I endure a lot of grief. And don't think that I just come do this show and there's not backlash behind it. Some people are built for it. Some people aren't. And I'm not saying for pity. I'm just saying, you look across this country, and yes, you do say, well, where are the so-called good officers? Why are they not speaking up? Some of them can't because it becomes life-threatening. And then some people don't want to deal with the side eye, be called names, be called this and that. But that's fine because you know what? As long as the naysayers and the haters are listening to you, they're learning. They're towing a company line that is shattered and broken and torn and disconnected from the community it serves. Not everyone wants to stand up for it. And I got some officers who tell me, you know, hey, man, I support what you're doing. I like what you're doing. Some will agree with me, some won't. But this is, when you talk about police officers criticizing and pointing out things that are wrong in the profession, it is not viewed favorably by other officers, including some of their spouses, and I don't mean this in any derogatory manner, who oftentimes don't know what's going on in the police department. They don't know. You know what your husband comes home and tells you and what you see. You don't know what's going on in these departments a lot of times. So that's why some officers don't speak up about what's going on in the department. I agree. If they did, the community would trust them. There are people in my community here that may not like the police department, but they trust me. But that's because they see me in the barbershop. They see me in the grocery store. They see me in the corner store. You know, they see me at the church. They see me here. They see me out of uniform. They see me as a person. They don't have to call me officer. They can call me Stan or Mason or whatever. And that's just me. I got to do me. But you just hit the nail on the head. If police officers would learn to do that, their survival rate would go up a lot in some of these communities. So that community will watch your back and tell you when something's wrong. I know because I'm just finishing up policing one for 25 years. But this community here has 1,000% backed me, supported me, been in my corner, looked over my back. I mean, and not just black folks. White, Hispanic, rich, poor, gay, straight, Republican, Democrat. You know, everybody's not going to like you. But if you're going to hate me, you're going to hate me because you don't like the truth. I just happen to be the vessel that carries it. Am I always right? No. But, you know, that's the way life is. But you're 1,000% right. More should speak up. But that's a fear
Thank
thing
you.
That's internal in policing to where they want. And I agree with you 1,000%. And that's my personal answer. Some folks, I'm not even going to give the political one because y'all would know that's BS anyway, so there's no need to be wasting people's time and even going to it. I'm going to drop to another caller. Your mic's still open, but I'm going to go to 203 area code 7463. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. What up, Stan? What's up, Adrian? MVP in the house. What's up?
What's
hey.
Up, man?
I'm good. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. How's your wife, man? Family, everybody good?
Wifey's good, life's good, guys go all the time, man. Everything's all right, man. So we know, everything's on the move. You know, we're on the motion. So I was listening to part of your show, and, you know, I have to put an initial comment basically saying how we have to be a community. And within that word community is the last five letters, U-N-I-T-Y. We have to have unity amongst our relationships that we're building in our communities, in churches,
mm-hmm.
with police officers, with schools, with non-for-profits, et cetera, et cetera, and because there's a dire need. Now, we know what the deficits are, and a lot of times we can talk about it, but we must have solutions. And in my community, in Bridgeport CT, let me give you an example. So in Bridgeport CT, it's all about solutions. So I work with Job Corps, work with the ages 16 to 24, kids who are considered, according to society, at risk, kids who are on the verge of going to jail, dropouts, probation, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm saying, instead of pathologizing them, let's get these kids out of here so they become assets and not liabilities. And part of what needs to be done is planting these seeds, networking, building, and really come to that common cause of how can we be a better society? You know what I'm saying? So we all need to just play that role. And this has nothing to do with politics. This is about human decency. This is about character.
Mm-hmm.
This is about morale. This is about just
mm-hmm.
being compassionate and understanding of what's the atrocity that we've been having for so long and how can we be a better society. And you just got to continue to fight for that cause because if you don't fight for a cause, you're going to fall for everything. So you got to be able to stand up. And I agree with you. And let me tell you something, Stan. I'm just going to say this quick point and you can just jump right in. I agree with you when you said that if people hate you, That's because they don't want to hear the truth. A lot of times you hear people say, oh, I want to know the truth. Okay, well, I'm going to tell you the truth based on what I'm seeing, based on my experience. And they hate you for that. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Like I tell people, you can hate me all you want, but God loves me. So long as I got that, I'm good. And we're going to continue to keep going forward no matter what.
There you go. Because you know what, brother? It's so frustrating because when you look at a lot of these communities that are considered lost zones, just thrown to the wolves. There always seems to be these leaders in there that seem to be doing fine. Their lifestyle doesn't even reflect the poverty and the corrupt, you know, the poor people that are hungry and starving and can't afford health care. But the guy who's the leader of the community is coming in there in a Mercedes.
Yeah, you're right.
Look at it and you go, am I crazy? You know, at some point, and I had this discussion with an officer this morning that asked me, what do you think the answer is in for crime in a lot of neighborhoods? I said, the same way the answer is for policing in their training. You know, as long as we as officers continue to go to police classes where people with PhDs and all these titles and positions teach us, we're not learning nothing but statistics and facts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until in this country, we need to start empowering the people who are living through the conditions that we claim to be interested in solving and let them tell us what it's like. See, someone who's come back from the dead can tell you a lot more about what happens after death than someone who's too busy living for themselves. Tell you what it's like to be on drugs.
I'll tell you like this, Stan. I'll tell you like this, that a lot of it comes down to this. I think people have to police the community of where they live at. And what I mean by that is that you have to know the history of your hood. You got to know the history of what is around your environment. You have to know what's in your immediate neighborhood, like initially. You have to know that. You have to establish that. You have to know the historical impact of what the neighborhood has become based off the town that you grew up to how it is now. And you have to tap into those sources. Like in my community, for example, we have Bridgeport Police Department, my church that I go to. So what I'm saying is that we're going to these places, we're going to schools to really bring people to the round table to address the issues that you're talking about, the poverty, you know, incarceration. We're talking about teen pregnancy. We're talking about shootouts, you know, theft, et cetera, et cetera. You know, people just having the basic employability skills to have a job. Just to have the basic necessities as far as being medically inclined to have basic health care. So these are the things that I'm doing. These are the things that I'm doing. And for the most part, I would say this, everyone is on board because they're saying we got to do better. Now, you're going to have those folks who are going to push back because they are disconnected, they're disinterested, or they lack empathy for those who are going through numerous sorts of sufferings. But you got to keep pushing forward. We can't just hang back and stand back and just say, well, you know what? It is what it is. No, we got to push. And if that means you got to push the envelope to make it open, then that's what we're going to do. If that means you got to make things uncomfortable to draw attention, then that's what we're going to do. And I tell people, if you have been unaffected by, let's say, sufferings, for you to understand what we've been screaming for years, let that be you. Give an example, police brutality. You hear about the stories about unarmed men and women of color being gunned down by cops when they walk away unpunished.
Mm-hmm.
You have folks that never experienced that. And I tell people, you want to experience that? Let your kid, who's unaffected, get 2 shots in the head and a cop walks away unpunished. Now you're going to see where we're coming from. And I think for some people, those inevitables have to happen for them to understand this is what we've been saying for so long.
Right. That goes back to, like, all the solutions that have come out. We as people have to understand there are some aspects of this whole saga that we do not have an experience in. So, therefore, we're not in a position to say, and this is what really gets me when they say, well, I don't believe that happens. Well, just because, you know, if you see UFOs, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, dead relatives floating through the living room, leprechauns, all these things that no one else has seen, but you can't see that someone else may have gone through something that you as a male may not go through. or you as a black person or a white person may not go through. See, that's the thing. We need to meet people at their condition instead of showing up saying, well, I'm here to help you, and as soon as you get off your ass and crawl over here to me, I will bless you with my help, for I have arrived. That's crap.
That is crap.
But that goes back to one of the aspects of this that never seems to happen. This is why people fizzle out. Neighborhoods never celebrate their success. When I worked in neighborhoods and we worked together, once we restored a neighborhood, we had a block party. And everybody came out. And every day, annually, on that day or the first Saturday of that week, that neighborhood has got to come out and celebrate the reclaiming of that neighborhood, because it instills in the young people as they grow why we're having this block party. We're not having it just to stand out there and twerk and get turned up and play a bunch of loud music. You're there to enjoy each other. But when neighborhoods stop celebrating your victories, you know, it's a sad dog that won't wag its own tail.
Yeah.
When you stop celebrating, you lose interest as to why. And then you don't, the block part goes out. You just have the party. Then the party turns into the shootout. The shootout turns into the crime scene. The crime scene turns into the bad neighborhood. And then the bad neighborhood turns into the mess that you just got out of 5 or 10 years ago. So, and you know, we all have to come together and work on these problems.
I think I'm looking at it like this. No, it's not easy. It's not easy. But I think as people that's from the neighborhood that understands and can fathom the issues that's been ongoing, that's plaguing, we know what goes on. We just got to just, you know, get out of our comfort zone and continue to just push, continue to just challenge, you know, not as per se challenge authority, but we need to challenge some of the thought processes as far as why certain neighbors are the way they are. Because a lot of times you always hear, oh, they talk about it as far as, you know, why certain neighbors are the way they are, or why there's always going to be a negative connotation among neighborhoods, among people there. But instead of pathologizing and kicking somebody while they're down, no, let's help them. Because a lot of what they can offer, we can learn a great deal of.
But we, as so-called leaders, and which I'll hold myself in because of, you know, position of police officer, you're historically seen as a leader and this and that. Not everybody's got that badge on is capable of doing it, but be that as it may, you know, until we as leaders or people who are viewed as leaders can say, I don't know. I'm in this mess with you. I don't know what the hell we're going to do.
Yeah.
Well, will the city help? The city can't do it. Well, let's go over and get the church. Well, the church has been here for 50 years and the problem's still here. Well, ain't nobody here but me and you. Then you know what me and you sit at. And sometimes it's as simple as going straight to the problem. And then you may not know what to do, but once you get there, you've done more just by going and seeing it, because so many people are legislating solutions without going to the problem, preaching sermons on it without going to the problem, giving advice without going to the problem. There should be cultural diversity classes twice a month held in recreation centers when different parts of the community stand up and teach other parts of the community about their culture.
Right.
Just because you live next to somebody who's Mexican does not mean you understand Mexican culture. Just because your best friend that sits in the cubicle next to you is black does not mean you understand black people. Just because you've got a white guy that you know, play basketball with once a week doesn't mean you know white people. We've got to stop being afraid to have that conversation. Because in America,
and we should,
that is the biggest joke.
Listen, couldn't say any better myself. That's what it comes down to, is building those relationships. And I've always said this before, and I'm about to go finish my workout, but I definitely want to continue to support your show. I know you're going to rock and do great things. I'll say this quickly before I get off the phone, is that part of it is about building relationships. And I've always said this before, and I'm going to say this again. If you want to understand somebody, spend 5 years of someone's life to know what they have gone through on a day-to-day. And if you're not even going to do that much, walk a mile in somebody's shoe. Now, if you're not even going to walk a mile in somebody's shoe, then what you say bears no fruit to me, and it means nothing to me. And I'm going to just say, you know, with that being said, you know what I mean? So with that being said, we just got to continue to go forward. understand. God bless you. Keep doing great things. I know you're going to rock, man. We're going to talk again soon.
All right, brother. Appreciate you. Tell the family I said hi. And y'all try to stay warm up there.
Yes, sir. Same here, my brother. Same here, brother. Do your thing, man. We'll talk soon. Yes, sir.
All right. So, Gus, the other callers. Now, we put a lot more on the table. You know, I want you guys to drop back in here, you know, fill in, because this is something where I want a lot of people that are listening to hear what the community thinks, especially some of the officers, some who really listen because they're interested in the show, and then some of them are trolls that are on here just to have something to run back and talk about. So I want them to hear from y'all how y'all feel, so maybe they can run back and tell that.
Amen.
You know, there's a lot of work to do. A lot of work to do. I mean, we look at these communities right now. This is a perfect situation. If you look at all these elected, these people that are running for political positions, all of them have a plan for the poor community. All of a sudden, everybody came up with this plan. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Why haven't you been doing it? I don't care about you. See, that's the thing about this show. I don't care that you're black or white or Republican or Democrat. It doesn't matter. It don't work in here. Everybody right now has a plan. Where was this plan last year or the year before when people were out here hungry? People were out here homeless. People were out here with no health insurance. Schools shutting down. The schools are the backbone of a lot of neighborhoods. They're not just these entities that make money and some of them don't even do that and put up and babysit your kids. They're a cornerstone of the neighborhood. You know, the Bloods and Crips are starting to sell soda. The Crips are. They're going to sell soda. They're even getting their act together. So what are we waiting for? We as citizens, we as police officers, yes, you have to go by the orders that your department says. Yes, you got to go by the department policy. But you also have a mind. And you can think, and you can become part of these communities. And if you say, well, I don't live in this troubled area, but you work in it. You're spending 40, 60, whatever your work schedule is, hours a day there. Some of these people don't have anybody but us. Yes, they may hate us. They may say they don't like you. They want you out. But you're all they have. And you just sometimes have to give a damn. 469 area code, 1656, good morning.
How you doing there, Stan? How you doing, all the
Big
everybody's
Bobby,
listening?
Up?
Not much. You know, basically what you're talking about when we're talking about community policing is basic involvement. When you sit around and you just put some stuff on the board and throw darts at it without going to the source. You know, mm-hmm. you take a lot of people in some communities that don't have jobs, and people automatically think, well, people are lazy. But the truth being told in a lot of those situations is some people just don't know how to fill out a job application. And then you take it to a different extent. Some people don't know how to conduct themselves in the interview. So how do we fix those things? We talk to people and we ask them, you know, why do you not have a job? And then in the communication with them and involvement of helping them solve their own problem, we find out what the real issue is. And if the issue is you don't know how to fill out an application, then we can direct them to resources in the community or sometimes outside of the community that can teach them Uh-oh. How to fill out an application. Then, once you fill out the application, let's do a mock interview, and let's see how well you were doing the interview. We don't know that unless we're in that situation. So it's certain ways that you conduct yourself in an interview to get a job. I don't care how good your resume is and how good you fill out the application. This is just the truth of the matter. You cannot do what you have never done and do it well unless somebody teaches you. Now, a lot of people, through trial and error, they learn through the evolution of being in these interviews, well, I answered that question wrong, so let me do a better job of doing it. But if we have the resources, and once again, this involvement, there are resources in the neighborhood that people may not be aware of. So when they start talking to the police or the different people in the community that say that they're leaders, you find these things out and you start directing them to those resources. And then you have a common person or a layman person, introducing them into a professional person in that field that can show them how to be successful. You take that not only with jobs, you do it with a lot of other things. You know, a lot of people in the communities that are renters will want to be homeowners. But do you know how to buy a house? Do you know the process? No. But so when people teach you these things and utilize those resources and all these things that I'm putting on the table, they seem simple and common, and you say, well, people should know that. Well, if people know better, they do better. But when you get them involved in solving issues, that is what we call empowerment. That is what we call motivation. That is what we call unity that you guys are speaking on. The things that we know, we have to share. Now, will people be resistant? Some of them will.
Yep.
But most of them won't. But if we don't reach out, if we don't make a conscious effort to try to teach and help people utilize these resources, then you have to sit back and say, if we got all these grants, these city grants, to put the resources in those neighborhoods and they're not being utilized, that's a bigger problem because that's a waste of money and talent.
May I interject?
Yes.
Absolutely, yes. Stay on, Bob. So, don't hang up. Come on, Dale.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm in Detroit. I run a school, survival school, that I created since 1995. And with my school, I created a bodyguard organization that protects inner city people and suburban and country people, but mostly inner city because that's where we're at. And I used, in the 90s, guys that just got out of prison because that's the only ones willing to go out into the hood and actually protect families from violent crime. I tried to get other people, but some would. I had some off-duty police officers. I had some regular people, professionals, but most of them were people from the neighborhoods who were what they call at risk. And what I found was that these people were not at risk. They were people that were just not provided protection. That's what made me evolve from just being a school to actually protecting the people. And as a result of protecting families, stopping home invasions and murders, the community actually began to prosper. The building owners went into the red for the first time in 20 years. The police department got all the credit, and the poor people got to have a good quality of life free of abduction and home invasion and murder. The wealthy people were then richer because of the protection for the poor people, which was my goal, which is to make people safe. So I just make rich people pay me for the outcome, and I still do it to this day. But now my business has evolved, so I don't have any felons that work for us, but I did have a chance to teach them over the years how to do an interview. And what that gentleman just brought up was excellent. I teach everything from articulation to voice inflection, facial expression, combined with actual business etiquette. You know, and then I do tutoring to people who are entrepreneurs starting their own business, because I actually saw, now have I seen like hundreds of people in business fail, but I've also seen some winners. And most of the winners I saw were grassroots guys that start off with no money and just, created their own business. And they did it through hard work. And then I know a lot of people that have advanced college degrees that are not nearly as financially well off as these people that have no college degrees. And so I see a direct correlation between ingenuity and initiative and an outcome more so than academia. And so what I do is I go to schools, including just this week, and still teach urban kids about success and excellence, about work ethic. But we need to understand that without protection, none of those things are human conditions that can work, and we need to stop hating on poor people. There's no correlation between poor people and poverty. That's a psychological, that is not true. That is something that's completely wrong. You can go to I went to poor churches down south, and I'm telling you, poor people will give you a chicken and stuff for free. They will give you a shirt off their back, okay? And you go to a wealthy church, they're not giving you nothing, and you got to give money to participate in all kinds of activities. So the concept that the poor people are the criminals, are the problem, is not true. What we did was we conceived of poor people as crime. I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's a suburban town. As an only African-American that would be driving down the street, I was pulled over constantly. And what I noticed was that the concepts of my European-American friends that were doing crime that I grew up with, their crime is called joshing around, or it's called youthful exuberance, or it was called joyriding. When I went to Detroit, marijuana was still illegal, but where I'm from, Ann Arbor, they've been smoking weed out in public since the 60s. and the police don't beat you up. They might take your weed. And the European Americans I grew up with were drinking, smoking, speeding. Sometimes they would just take off from police like Dukes of Hazzard. Anybody knows anything about that TV show? And they would not be killed. They would not be beaten. They would just be, like, spanked and taken home. The police would not do any of those things you see on TV. And so I grew up there. So I came to Detroit, and I saw the African-American police officers from the same neighborhood of these people that need their help doing worse to them than the European-American police officers. I was very upset. I'm still upset. And I employed both European-American and African-American police officers, but 90% of my staff are civilians, and 80%, 90% of my staff are African-Americans, Americans of African heritage, I should say. So the reality is, I employ people, and my understanding of conditions and situations and outcomes is over a 25-year period and getting a chance to talk to probation officers, parole officers, police issues. I've been training police officers and civilians, so I have a unique understanding because for me it meant I could eat or not eat. It meant that I personally am going to suffer if my people make mistakes, my staff members make a mistake. I'm personally accountable politically and financially. So I say all that to say that I see things differently because I had to, because the reality of what I have experienced requires me to see truth, right? And so these narratives that we're working from, like poor people do crime, that's not true. They've created a prison just for wealthy people like Bernie Madoff, who stole more money than all the poor people in the history of this country combined. Enron is a corporation that stole... Yes, they stole more money than everyone. So we got to stop the narrative, okay? There are more European-American males with no father than there are American males with no father. We have to stop listening to these negative, nefarious narratives, okay, and realize excellence and resilience is here. Now you live it. Now stop living negative, nefarious narratives that TV brought. And remember that, you know, everything we've been shown is Eurocentrically programmed, right? So when you looked at Hazard, Dukes of Hazzard as a kid, you have to realize those guys are drug dealers having fun with their little sister wearing tight clothes. But if that was an African-American, that would be bad drug dealers, and they're selling their sister, you know, sexually. And so, right, exactly. New Jack City, yeah. At the end, you lose. You don't get a new TV series. And my point is we need to, as part of our healing process from slavery, is realize that we're still suffering the PTSD from slavery because it was handed down from our parents and the conditions we've still been living in. And so we're not even through with the – we haven't really begun – we're beginning the healing process, absolutely. But we need to understand that PTSD is psychological, and the more games we play with data, meaning we're listening to what's being told to us, the more we can't have a healthy mental picture of reality. So European-American police officers – that might be a good person for you, you're going to have a negative feeling towards, and an African-American officer, you feel like there should be some kind of connection when there isn't, and this is going to be a negative outcome. What I'm saying is judge people for who they are, treat people for what they show you, and respect people for how they behave, regardless of what they look like, and you're going to be a much more happy and successful person.
Yeah.
Cool. Hang on the line, Dale. I'm keeping everybody's mic open. I'm going to grab another caller that I've had waiting for a while. Up there in the 213 area, code 4815. Good morning. You're behind the blue curtain. What's going on?
How you doing, Stan? This is Rob from the Round Table.
Come on, man. What's going on, Rob?
Definitely shout out to everybody on the panel and whatnot. I just wanted to jump in and talk about the economics again. I like how you tailored this show for spread the wealth, but we have to also remember that, you know, spreading the wealth, first off, it's not a bad thing because, you know, we actually have enough money to eliminate poverty in this country. I was just talking about that yesterday. But, of course, when you have people who, as you said, in the police departments, like a certain police departments like to hold on to their what works for them, and they don't want to share that with other people. I mean, we have to learn to break this mold and understand that nobody has to be poor. And yes, it was said before, poverty is not a crime. And the next level from poverty, in my opinion, is entrepreneurship, is business ownership. I think that ultimately, I don't know if there's a way for the police unions to get involved, but at the same time, like a lot of these areas that are high in crime, you know, as has been said before, they have low credit scores, they're unemployed, they have nothing else to do, and you know, especially in America, we've just forgotten about the third world. You know, that's right there in our backyard. And I think that taking it to another level, or at least trying to turn a page on poverty and explaining it to poor people that you're not criminals, that you too can have opportunities for wealth, that you can have opportunities. That, and then, you know, when you change the narrative, now we're not talking about thugs and gangsters. Now we're talking about potential businessmen, possibly potential police officers one day, police chiefs, mayors, politicians. But at the end of the day, you know, there's been a stigma in poor communities to where you can't get out of poverty. No, you can, but you have to be willing to. At the same time, you know, it like has been said in the past, it takes a village to run to, you know, a village to raise a child. But we have to be willing to stand with the poor people in our communities and say, well, how can we help you get back on your feet? If you have a drug addiction, okay, how can we get you involved in rehab? And, you know, if you owe a bunch of money, how can we help get some of your debt consolidated and or eliminated? You know, if you want to run a business, how can we bring 10, 20 of you together and bring in an SBA rep or just a community rep for entrepreneurship and maybe even, you know, a police rep to say that, look, you know, the police department is behind this program that's dedicated towards rehabilitating the community and thus reducing crime. I mean, at the end of the day, if we're just following the economics, that just because you're out of money doesn't mean that now you should, you know, be the first person to to be targeted in terms of smoking weed, in terms of, you know, having, you know, prostitution even, you know, because I noticed that in Fort Worth. Like, at the end of the day, when you have these different elements, I only named drugs and prostitution, but when you have these different elements of poverty that are always reoccurring, you have to ask yourself, well, what's the element that's working in those, or what's the part of those elements that's working so that we can flip that and that we can take it from being a negative situation. We turn a negative into a positive. Like that. That's I don't know if you understand if I'm making any sense, but that's the main gist I'm trying to get. That we have to learn how to break poverty as a positive and not a negative.
You're making a lot of sense, but here's my thing with just the word poor, that, you know, and it's an adjective, but what gets me is when we use it as a defining word, a descriptor, just a class of people, you're nothing but poor. And see, when you can master poverty, you can deal with success. Instead of giving people sympathy about their poor condition, teach them to understand that condition, master that beast, and now people are going, well, that doesn't make sense. Here's something poor people have that rich people don't. When you're poor, you don't have choices. Choices mean this or that, here or there, now or later. When you're poor, it's just this, that, now.
Stand
and once you master that, you take that potato and learn to do five different things with it because you got to stretch it out through the week. And you got rich folks who can't even order off the menu. So once you master that poverty and you teach the person to take that mastery and move it, I'm going to give you $5 today. Next week, once you stretch that $5 to go a week, when you get $10, you're going to be able to do twice as good with it. And you know, being poor is just like lifting weights or losing weight or anything. I think I'm not trying to trivialize it, but I think when you go through some of these conditions and you're able to pick yourself up and go, I did that.
Hey, that's a great analogy you just said.
You know, when you master poverty, the world is your oyster. Let's look at the people, some of the biggest inventors and innovators in this country are people who grew up poor. Some of your best entertainers and athletes, they grew up poor, and they learned how to take a dollar and stretch it.
You made a good point. You said
we don't have to live in a state of poverty and being poor, but if we fuel those people and see that poor is a condition that they may be in, that is a motivator, and then we go in with our well-meaning selves, and maybe we might sit down and learn that we could do a lot more with our dollar if we just acted poor for a minute. We could do a lot more.
Well, it's also, remember, it's also perspective, right? So
we could do,
a lot of poor people don't even know they're poor.
More, but we could do a lot more with our time if we just ask the poor. So in many instances, some of us who think we've arrived need to be poor again sometime.
Yeah. Also, Stan, you brought up a great point. You said that it's like working out, right? Like going to the gym, and you could work out. But now, let's be honest, how many people are overweight? Yeah.
What will make you get out of the big house and come down to the problem? You know, I just think that sometimes we ought to let these so-called poor people have the platform, because those of us who have arrived haven't even left yet. Some of us are so holy and perfect, God can't use us. Our friends are fake. Everybody's around you as a qualifier. When poor people come at you, they're real. And somebody already said it. They'll share whatever they got with you. And some of our so-called friends that made it are worried about, if I give you this, what will I have left?
Yeah.
Poor people, you never...
The majority of poor people have jobs. Let's remember that as well.
Yeah, but you know, I'm talking about even the ones that don't have that deal. You know, when you look at a bum camp or a homeless camp or a poor camp or whatever they want to call it, disenfranchised community, when you look at these homeless people, you don't see the black side of the camp and the white side of the camp.
Yeah, but also remember, mental health is a major issue. Overall, a lot of people that you see are homeless are not people that need a job. They need mental health.
Not even mental health, brother. Not even mental health. I'm talking about even within their condition of poverty, they don't even see color. They share, whether it's food or drugs. They share.
We're talking about pervasive problems. We have to remember that the majority of what you're seeing that's extreme, those are mental health issues. And all of us have mental health issues, let's be clear, everyone. Just some people are more able to use that, they're able to be more functional, right? But let's be clear that those people that you see are drug addicts are usually medicating mental issues and traumas in their life. So going to work is not necessarily going to help them. What they needed was mental assistance. They needed therapy. They needed medicine. And you're talking about millions of people now, because they've been having babies since there was no mental institutions for, you know, 30 years ago, once they shut down. Now the prison in California has the most psychotropics delivered to it, more than any other facility in the world, because the people in there they have mental illness that's on record. These are people that need medicine that never got it. And now we're giving them, you know, jail cells as their, mental therapy. And they did commit crimes because they're actually mentally ill, not because they decided to try to, you know, do some heinous act. These are chemical imbalances of their brains on a massive scale.
That's a whole different ball of wax.
Mentally imbalanced.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing that we're talking about. Let me get Tyrone in here real quick, who's been sitting back. Come on, Ty.
Yeah, I want to say, first and foremost, yes, of course. I would like us to, while we do these shows, I know you like to leave the mic open, but as your co-host, I would also like to express the importance of us showing respect for each other. When someone's talking, let them finish their point, and the butting in part, we got to stop that. We just have to. I want to first start off with commending Mr. Dale Brown for all his great works that he's done and continues to do in his area and other places in the country. And I'm not going to make it about him as it is about the principle. I've learned years ago, there's people who talk a lot, but then there's people who do a lot. There's people who like to talk about it, but there's people who be about it. There's people who talk about what can be done and what should be done, and there's people who do the things that need to be done. And that's why, because Mr. Brown did express some of the things he's doing. And that's just one individual. And look at what he's done. Look at what you, Officer Stan Mason, has done in your career. It all starts with the individual. Now, I will say this, that the narrative, it is not a false narrative. It's false as Santa Claus is false. And meaning, long as people believe that, it's not false in the people who believe that. Because it's what we, and it's from these points that we have to try to understand or overstand, better yet, how information is disseminated through mass media, the internet, and what have you. And when I mean mass media, you're talking about from your local to your MSNBC and all this stuff, these narratives. And I understand what Mr. Brown is talking about is false. It is false insofar as when you reject it. But what about the people who inject it, ingest it, and accept it? It becomes their reality. And this is a mindset that has to be reversed. It's no different than with bad information, bad food. There's going to be adverse conditions that are going to be the results of taking in bad food and bad information. Just like in the case of your vehicles, anybody who has a vehicle who takes certain type of fuel, you cannot put diesel fuel in a gasoline tank. You cannot put kerosene in a diesel tank. You got to have the proper fuel. And a lot of things that we take in, mind, spirit, and soul, seeps just into that, and then it's carried out by the body. So that what is, and I understand what Dale is saying about the false narrative. It is for us who know the truth. But so many people don't really want the truth. They really don't. They like to hear it, but hearing it, it comes down to a matter of heart. What are you going to do once you hear it? Are you going to follow up on it? Are you going to do something about it? Are we just going to continue to talk about it? So we have to come up, which obviously Brother Dale Brown has done in his works, come up with a counter-intelligent, real plan that is solution-orientated to offset the false narratives. And it's obvious that the people who he has trained and helped through his tenure in his business, they now are healthier, wealthier, and I don't mean just wealthier in the sense of money. I'm talking about the mindset. Because, see, we can run out of money, but when we run out of ambition, we run out of determination, we run out of motivation.
Agreed.
If we run out of reinforcing knowledge and information, then mm-hmm. that leaves us damn near out of hope. And that's where a lot of people who you see in what is labeled as a poor community come as people who now are hopeless. And that's why Stan says every
Amen.
Show, knowledge is power. So we got to mm-hmm. get information that's not going to drain us or decharge us. We need, it's like that battery. We need a constant do what with our batteries? We have to need a constant recharge because there is a narrative out there that's constantly trying to decharge us and drain us. Another thing I like to say about this collective thing called what we talk about spreading the wealth. People who really care spread wealth. You don't have to ask them. You don't have to tug on them. You don't have to twist their arm. They just give it freely. But see, there's a perception mm-hmm. that there's a whole lot of people that they care. They have a sense of care, and they really don't. They're just great actors, and they need to get some Academy Awards by the way they're acting like they do care. Because as Brother said, I believe it was Rob from the Roundtable, we can get rid of poverty in this country if people, everybody, and I'm not saying everybody's going to do it because we know that ain't even going to happen in Hollywood. Let's make that clear.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to take a vested interest and see this not as like what some officers will take their as it's just a job, or in many cases, it's a career. Us in the community have to see it as part of our job and as a career. To do what? Coming down to following up, doing what's necessary, not use the word community as just a word or a phrase, but as Rob said, I think, when he was speaking about unifying, unity. That's a common unity. So that mindset has to be changed where individuals start first, as Brother Ron, Dale has done, and of course Stan and many others on this panel, and then from the individual, you spread it to the family out in your homes, to the neighborhood, and hopefully, you know, spread the good like cancer spreads, you know what I mean? And turn that community into a living reality to change the ugly face of the game that they've been playing with us for quite some time, and though it's really not a game. Because it's truly mind over matter. We got to put the right stuff, because people are ready for change. A lot of people say they're willing to change. They're able to change, capable, but it comes down to doing
it. Most people hate it.
Are we going to assume, and I'm not just saying an assumption. I'm saying assume to the sense of resume our personal responsibility for taking responsibility and accountability that will start to add up. Not subtract from our community and our quality of life and our freedom and our and when I say freedoms, I'm saying freedoms from away from the sickness and the shattering ways that as Ron, I believe Dale was talking about the mental health. we there's a lot of freedoms we got to break chains from. It ain't just a cycle of physical change with that came through slavery. There's a lot of mental change. There's a lot of emotional changes right now in our people. And if we're ever going to have equality, and mind you, equality just simply means balance. It's a balance of power. But people who are in control don't want to relinquish that power. So let's
That's
be
right.
clear on that. There are people who are greedy. They don't want to see other people empowered. So, yes, I'm going to have to go to what my brother Robert Drake's son, Michael Fee, said a long time ago. He made an acronym called POOR. And POOR simply means passing over opportunities repeatedly. But we have to present opportunities.
I like
we have to create opportunities. And just like in the Nike slogan, just do it. All right, what is it they talk about? There's the thrill of victory and there's the agony of defeat. Aren't we as a people tired of the agony? And for God's sake, more power to the people. So we have to be endowed with the information to empower one another, to elevate, not degrade, and really get back into care. And this is the acronym for CARE. Consistent action, resurrecting, evoluting. And that just simply means grow these communities, not destroy them. If we have to rehab them, then we do that, as Brother Sam said. And talking is just the starting point. That is not the finish line. So we are talking about it. All right? And it's good to talk about it. But what did I say earlier? There's a lot of talk a lot, but we got to get more people to do a lot. And I appreciate brothers like Brother Dale Brown and with his works, and obviously Officer Stan Mason, anybody out there who's doing what they can do as an individual, because it all starts with us. Because we're going to be on this journey. We're going to be on this place called life. It's a destination we have to reach. So on the destination, remember, we're in a marathon. We're not in a sprint. So we have incremental increases in wealth, incremental increases in knowledge, incremental increases in job training. We just got to keep pushing. Keep on pushing. And don't let anything, anyone discourage you where it leaves you in that place that I spoke about earlier. Run out, you're hopeless. You no longer have an ambition. You no longer are determined. You're not motivated anymore. And you just give up and you in the way of the white towel. No, we are at war. And we have to protect ourselves in more ways than one. Emotionally, mentally, obviously physically, and spiritually. Because we're getting beat up on all four points right now, if y'all understand that point. We're getting beat up on all. And we need self-defense. We need martial arts. Meaning artistic ways to defend yourself when they're coming at you from all courts. So there is a correlation between what they have created, the narrative called POOR, which unfortunately so many people have ingested and injected, and they've mainlined it right into their hearts, and they have accepted this. And as long as we keep accepting that, we will keep reproducing that, and we'll keep recycling this thing called poverty, and this thing called drug addiction, and we'll keep, you know, crime and all this, is because we like the script. Let's change the script. And again, I'm going to thank Brother Dale Brown for all his great, wonderful works and continue on. And as well, Officer Stan Mason, who we know is about to retire in a couple of weeks. But we need more people. Stop sitting in front of the TV, as I was watching a thing today, and it says, because you know what happens is we just become. We don't be participants. We be what? What do we do if we're not participating? All we're doing is watching life unfold. We're spectators.
Cheerleaders.
Stop spectating, cheerleading. Let's get in the game, as Stan would say. Put some skin in the game. Otherwise, sit down on the sideline, because he will say over and over, just because they're on your sidelines with you, that don't mean they're on your side on the side with you. Thank you again, Stan. Thanks.
I think you brought up some great points.
We're down to the end of it. What I'm going to do now is we're going to hit that barbershop round. I'm going to go down all the callers that have called in and that have given their time and given us their insight. You know, you get 2 minutes, and it's not a debate. It's not a back and forth. It is your 2 minutes where nobody's going to talk with you, and you're going to get a chance to talk about anything you want to talk about in life, anything you want. It's your 2 minutes. I'm going to start up in the big 804 with my brother Gus. Come on, Gus.
All right, man. First, I want to say what a great commentary, as always, by my brother, TKG. It was powerful, and I took heed to a lot of the stuff in it. But I want to get back to – and I like that acronym for POOR. The brother needs to copyright that. I'm just piggybacking on someone what he said. Being poor is not a disease. It's a whole lot of poor people out here who work every day, living paycheck to paycheck. That technically means you're poor. If you work, don't have any money after you work and get paid, technically you're poor. That doesn't mean you're low life. That doesn't mean you're sitting on waiting for a government handout. It just means that maybe some opportunities that or some bad decisions you made in your life put you in the position that you're in. And also, I agree with, you know, instead of calling people poor, hopeless. Some people have no hope, man. They don't see a way out. If you third and fourth and fifth generation on public assistance and you don't know how to get out of that condition, there's got to be somewhere where you can reach out and try to improve your condition. But I want to say, Stan, thank you for the show. I mean, it's always wonderful, and I get a lot of good insight of it, especially from that commentary from your co-host. I enjoy it, man, and God bless you guys, and have a great day today.
Hey, Gus, I appreciate you, man, always being here, man, always lighting up the lines, first one up there, always good positive input, and, you know, I talk to you throughout the week, man, and I'm going to tell you, it means a lot sometimes. You always got a good word to lift me up, so, brother, you be careful out there. Enjoy your weekend and take care of yourself.
All right. Thank you, too. And big out to the brother that was speaking, man. I forgot his name, Dale Brown. Appreciate the commentary and the stuff that he did. So thank you again.
All right, brother. We appreciate you, Gus. We're dropping down to the 414 area code 0432. You got 2 minutes. Anything you want to talk about?
Sandy, well, I would just like to say I appreciate the work you do in your own community. I'm always looking at your posts, and everybody's always congratulating you, thanking you, and remembering you for years ago. And I just want to say that we have to do better for ourselves, and it starts within our home, in our community. Let's work together with these politicians, the police officers, to do better. And just because some of us live in poverty does not mean we're unhappy people. You have to live like you want to be treated. And me having a special needs kid, my concern is about the police officers, but we develop a program through the Autism Society to help try to ease some of that comfort that a lot of parents have by working with the police station, getting our kids out there so that they'll recognize who our kids is. And I think that needs to be a program that's spread all over the United States. And I appreciate you having me on. Stay blessed.
Well, we're gonna hook up because I wanna I'm gonna give you hang on a second. I'm gonna get back with you because I wanna know a little bit more about that program, and we'll do a program and we'll bring you on and you're gonna be the expert and the co-host and fill us in on that program so maybe we can get that program to go around the United States. What you think about that?
I'll get all the information ready for you.
Okay. Well, I got your number. Sit down and I'll give you a call. It probably won't be till this evening. And we'll sit down and we'll see, that's the thing I like about this show is we meet so many people doing so many great things that they're not always in the newspapers and the titles. So here this lady's got something that somebody listening right now is their answer. It's what they've been searching for. So we're going to put that show together and you're going to be on and you're going to talk to the world. And maybe we can get that program started everywhere because Lord knows it's needed. And I appreciate you getting up early on a Saturday and calling up here and listening to me rant and listening to me, you know, thank God I got you all to put in some useful information because some of this I do get personal with it sometimes because it's just a lot. And when you care, that happens. But I appreciate you calling and getting up early and being here with us. And you enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. We'll see you. All right, dropping down to the 469 area code, 1656. Come on, 2 minutes, anything you want.
Yes, sir. The acronym POOR, passing over opportunities repeatedly. We have to add, that was developed and we continue to add content to it. You cannot get out of poverty if you continue to do poor things. The first thing you have to do is you have to someone expose you to something that causes you to invest in yourself. That's the most important investment that you can make. When you start investing in yourself, then you're able to get yourself to a level where it's, where you can start investing in other people. Sometimes we have to understand also that we can't do these things because we don't have the resources as an individual. So you have to connect yourself with organizations that broaden your reach. I never would have thought, Stan, growing up in Waco, Texas, that I would end up in Dallas and end up in the situation or position that I'm in now. They have a thing out here in Dallas in the community college district that I work in called a 60 by 30. And what this means is we want to elevate through education 60% of this community out here in Dallas-Fort Worth by the year 2030. And people think, well, that's a long way down the road, but it's not as far down the road as we think it is. But through my drive, through my motivation, I find myself partnering and being on committees with people that we all have the same common goal. We're not just trying to elevate the black community, the poor community, or the black and brown or green community. We're trying to elevate the entire community out here in Dallas by 2030. This costs money, and this is where I'm saying it may be bigger than what you could achieve on your own. We put it in front of the board, the chancellor. That's his job. He collected all these ideas from everybody, common people, and people with high education, people with low education. $1.1 billion is what he estimated it's going to cost. The board has approved it. Now it has to go in front of the voters in May. $1.1 billion. This is not something probably that one person out here in Dallas would do on their own or could maybe achieve on their own. But collectively, we are going to reach that goal. 60% of the community educated are lifted up, higher than where they are right now by 2030. Now we have to also say, what about the other 40%? So guess what we're doing now? We're developing a plan for the other 40% of the people. But the goal is what Tyrone said, and that's why when you have chemistry between people, you can sit back and be quiet. I knew that he was going to go with the poor thing, passing over opportunities repeatedly. We have to reach out to people in, at the high school level. We have to look at problems in Dallas, Texas, and have a strategic plan on how to fix those things. In Dallas, Texas, we have a problem hiring police officers. So guess what? Mm-hmm. Through education, we're going to put it on the table. How can we help the Dallas Police Force get officers that are at the level that they need to be? It's going to come through education. So we'll have to go to Texas, to Austin, and change policies and say, hey, can we have a bachelor degree program at a two-year college that can help us educate those officers, people in the community, to fill those positions as officers? How do we know that it's possible? Because we had a shortage of nurses. And what did we do? People got together, and they say, how can we close this gap in the nursing community in Dallas, Texas? Let's go with a two-year degree plan to get a bachelor's degree at a community college so people don't have to go 4 years to a university. How did we achieve this?
Right.
We got a partnership with the universities to make this come and go. So that thing and what MVP was talking about, Robert Velez Jr. was talking about unity and community, that's the answer, folks. All of us doing our little bit. Dale, I appreciate the things that you're doing. And people follow me and Dale on social media. They see me and Dale get into a lot of heated debates. But it's family. Family doesn't always agree. But through those heated debates,
agreed,
I learn a lot from his point of view, and I add what I learn and put it into my character so I can be better, and I hope that he's doing the same thing. And that's what we have to do, folks. We have to stop being poor, passing over opportunities repeatedly.
All right, brother. All right. I appreciate you, man. As always, I'm going to holler at you a little bit later. I'm going to drop down to the 213 area code, 4815. 2 minutes, anything you'd like to talk about.
Thanks again, Stan. Let's just remember that you can't have political sovereignty if you can't have economic sovereignty. I was told that, about 10 years ago, and, where that ties in today, let's remember that poor people, have a way out of poverty. Don't ever convince yourself that you can't get out of it. Now, it is Black History Month, and I did get caught up in a conversation about it about a week ago that Martin Luther King, his quote unquote "I Have a Dream" speech, it wasn't about having a dream. We need to remember that he was talking about the bounce check, the reparations, the money, the economic resources that poor communities were not able to obtain, and that's why they never got out of poverty. This was back in the
Black community.
Well, I mean, you know, Black communities, yes, but at the end of the day, we have to understand that a lot of the infrastructure that was built today in 2019 was built on the backs of poor minority people. And so if we don't mobilize those communities first, then of course we're going in circles. But we have to always remember that you know, while you know, I disagree with Dr. Ben Carson, who said poverty is a state of mind, let's also remember that you do have the ability, mental capability, to pull yourself out of it. You have to also, like I believe Drake talked about earlier, educate. He mentioned high school. I think we should be, in my personal opinion, Stan, I went to school in Dallas, you know, from, I believe, fourth grade to about sixth grade. And at the end of the day, like the point that I'm getting to with it is they brought police officers to the schools to come talk to us. So then, wait a minute, we can add something to that. We can say, well, why don't we recruit, you know, especially if possible at the elementary level, why don't we recruit people who understand how to teach kids about understanding wealth, understanding business ownership, understanding entrepreneurship at a basic level? I mean, because at the end of the day, poverty starts with the young people, because it's hard. It's very difficult to teach an old dog new tricks. So when we learn right. how to embrace, the youth ignorance as not like stupidity when it comes to economics.
30 seconds, brother.
And we start to embrace the fact that, you know, teaching our youth to embrace, you know, a higher level of thinking when it comes to economics, then we know how to solve these problems in relation to crime, you know, just in my opinion. But, I mean, definitely thanks again for having me on the show, Stan. Definitely shout out to the panel and everybody on. You always have, you know, a killer panel every week. Look forward to what we have going on next week. Thanks.
But, brother, having you there makes it a killer. I'm glad that you spend the time, and, you know, you've been in my corner a long time, man. I appreciate you. And, you know, you're always on the panel here. So, you know, you part of the barbershop crew. All right, Dale, we're going to drop down to you. Now, you got 2 minutes. That's 120 seconds. Because I'm
okay,
good.
I don't speak much, so this will be easy.
Come on, brother.
I want to address a couple issues. Number one, guys, whenever we say poor people, we have to remember the majority of poor people are now and always have been European Americans. So it's imperative not to allow that to be attached to any other ethnic group, because that would be disingenuous and untrue. When we talk about reparations and we talk about FDR's New Deal, we got to remember the poor people received billions of dollars in this country, but it was not African American or people of Latino or African heritage that received that money. Let's be clear. So we got to be very clear. Poor people did receive that money, which is why you see the social engineering you see now. These suburbs, these societies you're seeing are built by the government. The African Americans got projects. The European Americans got homes, land, businesses, and the tools and the training given by the government. So once you understand that, you cannot feel bad. You should feel the truth, and that is that there has been social engineering at work here for the entire population. Now, that being said, the next thing we have to do is realize that, in my opinion, from my experience, we have to separate. We are not a collective. I had to terminate my cousins because drunk driving is not allowed in my company. I have two different cousins. Both have college degrees, and I had to terminate both of them years apart because I don't allow you to drive my cars without passing a breathalyzer. So you have to do a pre-breathalyzer before you operate a protective service vehicle in my company. Both of my cousins both got terminated by me. That's because although they are blood relatives, I will not put at risk my integrity for anyone in my family or community that puts us at risk for improper outcomes. And that's where all of us have to do. We have to cut off the family members or people from the community that are not right. When I go to schools, they ask me, why do the good kids pull out a knife? This is a true story. On these gang members at a school. I charge them $150 an hour for me to go talk to them about why I charge the school $150 an hour. And I told them, I said, because you're not supposed to have gang members in the school with good kids, and good kids are supposed to protect themselves from gangs. They put the gang squad came in and arrested the good kid. He is now a felon. The bad kids, which are in a gang, are still terrorizing the neighborhood. So my point is, until we understand there are predators, there are violent criminals, we must separate them from the good people and the good kids and protect the good people. But there's no collective. There's no black crime, white crime. And if there was, the European-American crime rate would be ridiculous, including both World War I and World War II, where Christians that are European attacked the world twice. Okay, so the concept of using color is completely ludicrous. And my final statement is this. Every one of us has to sacrifice for the outcome. I had to spend over $1 million of my dollars so far, my own personal money. I have no government funding. I started off with a dog and a rifle and no money. The criminals stole my car. I had nothing. All I had was full-time ability to focus on family safety. And in doing so, I swear that people, this is why I get so offended when people say, you guys are like private police or something. Listen, I spent my own money to protect families, and I still do, because the protection is what's important, not the money. The money is my byproduct. I have a lot of money. I have more money than anyone that is a doctor or lawyer in my family, and I have many doctors and lawyers in my family. The money was never my point. My point was protecting the people. It turns out that if you keep families safe, poor and rich, what happens is there's money. There's prosperity from safe people. I just make the people that are rich pay me, and I use that, the wealth that I have, to provide protection for poor people that can't afford it. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for now 25 years. My point is, we all must sacrifice. We all must bleed for our community goals. And my community goal is to make sure that we make the world a safer place. And yes, it has hurt me because I had to spend my own time, energy, money, and I lost blood, physical blood. I have been injured before. Six of my staff members have been shot, one female, five men. None of us are dead because we stabilized our wounded through our education. We knew how to do that. My only point in saying all that is this. We all have everything we need to succeed. We need to look at people collectively as a human group. I protect European Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans, the same. Poor, rich, doesn't matter. Gay, straight, it doesn't matter. We protect everyone. And everyone needs to come together as a human society and stop the division. And people that are bad, no matter who they are, have to be cut from your life so you can focus on having a better life for yourself, your family, and your community. Thank you.
All right, before you go, Dale, tell them where they can find you. If some people wanted to reach out to you, where can they find you?
My organization is called Detroit Threat Management Center. We are expanding. We're going to be in Texas. We're going to be in Atlanta. We're going to be in other cities and other states. We got people in Nigeria that want us to come here as well, and New Zealand. So you can look us up on Google, Detroit Threat Management Center. You can also look at our website, threatmanagementcenter.com. And again, we're an educational organization and a protective service organization. 24/7, we respond 100% of the time and protect people in all communities under all conditions.
All right,
and we specialize in nonviolent outcomes. Let's be clear, just so you understand the difference between us and anyone else. We show people how to create nonviolent outcomes by teaching psychology, law, and skill in that order. So you learn gun disarms, knife disarms, close quarters tactics, but you first learn the law. So that's physical and criminal. That's criminal and civil law. So you understand lawsuits, but you also understand how to keep yourself safe from being prosecuted. And then prior to all of that, and the most important thing you learn is about praxeology, how to read body language, how to project body language, how to de-escalate situations by understanding voice inflection, facial expression, body positioning. How do you create peace through actual training? Through an actual system to replicate the conditions for the outcome you want, which is non-adversarial, non-violent, and peaceful by design. And that's what we do as a school, threatmanagementcenter.com.
There you go. Yeah, you got a number, phone number you want to give them, or you just want them to look at
800? Yes, 800-525-3491. 800-525-3491. And we are training people at our facility in Detroit. We have people flying in from other states, other countries that are training with us to take it back to their communities. How to create safety without violence. The actual tactics and strategies and skills to do that. Threat Management Center.
Well,
thank you. Thank you, Stan, for all you do, and I don't want to tell people that felons, these felons out here, I've been training them for years. A lot of them came back. I run a very strict operation, so if they disrespected anyone, they were terminated. But what I can tell you is this. I found out this is now 20 years later. They did not go back to prison.
You got 10 seconds, Dale. You got to
yeah. You can change. People can change, and I've seen it. I've seen very violent criminals. They said that I was the first person to ever talk to them. They wasn't scared of them, and that's because I know how to physically dominate them if I need to be honest, and I never had any fear of them. And as a result, they got respect. They had respect for me, and what I did was always told them, you know, straight up how to carry themselves, but also how to be more successful and not let the fact that they had committed crimes at some point in their past to affect their future. And it turns out, and I didn't know this, I actually thought they were going back to prison.
Nine out of ten of them did not go back to prison.
I just want to get that message out there that people do change.
Cool.
They can change. You've got to speak truthfully to them. You've got to be straight with them and don't play with them. I called them out on their foolishness, and I was very direct.
It went well. We're up against the clock, brother.
Okay,
but
thank you.
I appreciate you, brother, and hopefully we'll get you back in here again. All right, Ty, 2 minutes, brother. Take us on out of here.
Can I throw a little joke before I start? Dale is obviously a great, he's a great guy when it comes to security and protection, but he must be bad at math. I mean, for 30 seconds. Well, let me go. Hey, just a little icebreaker here. I just want to end by saying this. Real simple. It comes down to a matter of heart, where your passion is at. And if we don't follow up and follow through and do the things that's necessary that we should do, need to do, must do, as Dale said, to make this place a safer place, starting in our homes, and that comes with consistency and a commitment. It's obviously this gentleman, and as well as many people all over this globe right now, they're not going to be on TV, though. I say look at this overview and look at what we respond to in the sense of it's always we always reactionary. Unfortunately, we always react to what we see as a problem or the problem. And I said we have to reverse that mindset to look at it as a progressive challenge to whatever's going on. It's a quality of life issue. It's we got people who are sick and shut-in in more ways than one, and it's time to heal and become healthy and come out that box or come out that house and think out the box. Don't conform. Be creative. Reduce the stress and the regress and increase the peace and progress. Don't conform. Create, because conformity is weakness and it's set on fears. Creativity is strength and is built on courage. And that goes with every last one of us who truly wants to make a change in this world, starting with the individual. Thanks.
All right, Ty, I appreciate you. Well, I don't even need to add any much more on that. You guys can look up Dale Brown's information. I mean, real down-to-earth brother, which y'all saw, that's Dale. I mean, he's down-to-earth. He doesn't act like an idiot or a clown or stuck up. I mean, you talk to him and you never know that he is who he says he is. So, you know, definitely reach out to him. And, you know, my brother Tyrone K. Dunmore, Robert Drake, MVP, Gus calling in. I mean, you guys, I love all y'all lighting up the lines, Ali, Ali, Ali on the Facebook. You know, everybody over there having the sideshow. You guys have a good weekend. I want everybody to stay safe so we can all be back here next Saturday. Shout out to my people up in Harrisburg and, of course, people here in Waco that support me in the Dallas area. So I appreciate everybody. And Dale just put his website up on the Facebook link. You guys share the show, put it out there. You can go to the YouTube. You can go to StanMason.com, download the shows. Use them however you want. It's free. I don't charge for any of this. Shout out to my little sister. Just jumped on right at the end. We were waiting on you, girl. You're late. But anyway, I appreciate everybody. You guys have a great weekend. Take care of each other.
Love Ladies y'all. And gentlemen, please sit back because you are now about to go behind the blue curtain.
Mm-hmm.